The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
You're welcome back to The Hard Shoulder. Kieran Cuddihy with you until 7 o'clock. It is National Grief Awareness Week all this week. And Hugh McElveen is with me in studio. People will remember that Hugh joined me to talk about his daughter Eve a couple of years ago. And the conversation we had, Hugh, is in the context of Make-A-Wish and Dublin Zoo and the day out that was experienced by Eve when she was still with us. But just for people who are joining us now, I mean, can you tell us just a little bit about Eve? Remind us.
I will, of course. Thanks, Kieran, and thanks for having me back again. Eve was 13 when she passed away in December 22, and that was after 21 months of brain cancer. And I think when I was speaking to you, I think it was April that year, I think I was still in shock. I had not processed the grief. And Eve was vibrant, vivacious. I suppose the three adjectives I'd use to describe her most were very compassionate, very kind person, and wise beyond her years. And, yeah.
And when, if you now in hindsight, you look back and you say in April, kind of four or five months after she had died, you hadn't processed the grief. At what point did you process it, or are you still processing it?
Oh, I think you process it for the rest of your life. Okay. I mean, I think grief comes in different scales. You know, we can lose a family pet, and depending on how long we've had the pet, we'll grieve that pet for a while. It won't affect us for the rest of our life. Losing your child, I think you navigate that grief for the rest of your life. We all take on different roles within our family. And my role, I suppose, I saw was really to help and be the strong person that people could depend on. I suppose maybe taking on the father role. And after that as well, I felt that my son and wife still needed further support. So I kind of learned to keep my grief outside of the house. Also, my employer had been very good to me. And I had a mountain of work to catch up on afterwards. So it wasn't until last summer, almost 18 months after Eve died, myself and Catherine decided to walk half the Camino de Santiago to raise money for two of the charities that looked after Eve. And I walked the first week by myself. And I think that's when I really started to process it, because I had all this time to myself, all this time to think. And we can make ourselves too busy to grieve. I think that was big lesson I learned there.
What did that look like, that processing?
Oh man, I cried every day. I did all my crying up to that, sort of outside of the house, and I suppose walking the Camino, you were still outside the house. But I did most of the hospital visits with Eve, and so driving in the car without Eve after she died, I just felt this huge emptiness, and that's where I did most of my grieving, was outside the house, but it was short bursts. But walking something like the Camino, where you're walking for 6 hours a day and you've got all this time to think, you can't escape it, you know. And I suppose it was just overwhelming.
And after that, was there a marked difference then in how you kind of navigated the world? Did that allow you to kind of move on to a kind of another stage of processing?
I think so. I think when you process grief, it makes you far more compassionate, because you can recognize that grief in other people. And a good friend of mine, her daughter died 18 months before Eve, and she really was the best possible support to me, because she knew exactly what I was going through. Mm. She sent me a wonderful book called The Edge of Sorrow, which is a very non-denominational but spiritual approach to looking at sorrow. And that was fantastic. And 18 months into our grief, just after we walked the Camino, a friend of ours, her daughter died. And so we were able to pass the compassion on that my friend had given me to them. Mm. And then you realize that you're part of this chain of grief. And me looking at my friend in the very beginning, seeing her further down the road, that was just so helpful to say, you know, I can get there. I can be the strong person. And hopefully we were able to do something similar then for our friend. And it's just that compassion, I think, is what changed.
And, you know, for people who are lucky enough not to have experienced grief on this scale, and I count myself in that category, when you use a phrase like this chain of grief, it sounds morbid, kind of naturally, I think. It's the kind of reaction I would have. But what misconceptions or what understandings had you of grief before Eve passed away?
I understood very little of grief because I'd so little experience of it. What I did learn about grief is, and then I've went to an organization called Anamkara, which is a support for parents whose children have died. And I found that saw different ways people dealt with grief, some more successful than others. You can't sweep grief under the carpet. It's going to come back and bite you. You can't fight grief. It's always going to be there. And those are, I think, two short-term strategies when you're in the shock of grief. But you have to try form a relationship with grief, not make a friend of it, but you have to learn to navigate it, understand it, not deny it. By denying it, you don't talk about these things. They bottle up. They just become other problems. So you have to find a way of expressing it.
And the ways people express it as well. I mean, did you in your own family see different manifestations of it? Did you all express it in different ways?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think my son, in some ways, might have been the hardest hit because there is Anamkara for parents. I'm not aware of a similar organization for teenagers. And he lost his only sibling. And that was really, really tough on him.
Yeah.
Catherine and myself dealt with grief very, very differently. And Catherine's way isn't the way I would and vice versa. But observing her gave me so much opportunity to learn and see other ways of experiencing grief. And I did learn things from her in the process. And I do think we helped each other, even though we did it very differently. So I think the other thing I learned about grief is you have to be really open to other people's ways of doing things, because not one person has all the answers.
God, when you describe your son, I guess, as disordered as it is to lose a child, you would have a sense of your own mortality.
Yeah.
Like a child doesn't. And I guess suddenly he's kind of confronted with that as well as losing a sister and a sibling at that age, which again is not part of the natural order. He's kind of forced to confront the idea of his own mortality, which he's probably not equipped to do at a young age.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And he was an older teenager, so he didn't have all the answers or understand it all and was processing. It was tough. Eve's friends, who were 13, that was really tough on them because it's exactly as you say, as an adult, our child should not die before us, but we're aware that these things happen. Children expect their friends to be around for ages, and it's not just the death of a friend, it's the death of their innocence. And that's a double death. That's really, really tough.
But as well, you've got to then, as well as coping with Eve's loss, you've got to deal with that as parents as well.
Yeah.
That, you know, you're grieving for, I guess, the loss of your son's innocence to a degree as well.
Yeah, we're trying to help him, and he was absolutely brilliant, and he coped as well as he could. And we're all trying to help each other, and he was a great support to us. You know, he'd keep asking myself and Catherine, were we okay? And we were the only people who really understood, I suppose, what had happened, our triangle of three. Yeah.
Yeah. Are there things this far removed now that you look back on and you think, I didn't do that right at the start, or not right or wrong, or I wish I had done it differently. I wish I had thought about this more at the time, or I wish I hadn't said that or said something else.
I think hindsight in grief only serves to guilt trip you.
Okay.
Because if we could have done things differently, we would have. To believe that we purposefully didn't do things the right way is to say that we set out to undermine ourselves or the person. And of course, that's not true. So we can make a good decision and have a bad outcome. You can get into a car, put on your seatbelt instead of a crash. That was a good decision, a bad outcome. So we make the best decisions we can. The outcomes might not be the way we want, but we've still acted with integrity and honesty. And thinking back that we could have done it differently, well, it was impossible. We'd have to be different people.
Yeah.
So I think hindsight only serves us to sort of guilt trip ourselves and beat ourselves up. And in the middle of grief, that's not helpful.
How much of a journey was it though for you to get to this point where you can say that confidently? Did you go through that period, the guilt?
Well, I didn't, because that's my career. I teach decision skills, and that's kind of a part of it, you know, that hindsight bias. So I was lucky that I had that armor. But I've talked to other friends who've grieved and they haven't. And just when you frame it like that, they found it quite helpful.
Yeah. Is there a point in the process, the journey? It's what now? It's 2.5 years? Well, a little over two. Yeah. It'd be kind of 2.5 years in the spring, is it?
Yeah.
Where you ever felt the grief was overwhelming or it was most difficult to deal with?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I was talking to you last and we were talking about traveling to France for Eve, and I said, you know, without hope, what do you have?
Yeah.
And the opposite of hope, I think, is despair. It's just, it's an emptiness. And we've all been there. It's seeing people further down the road that allows you to pull yourself out of that despair, saying, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah. And, you know, Eve's friends and everything now when you see them, I guess there's a period after she passes whereby they're still in the same space that Eve was in terms of age and experience and outlook. And now you're getting to the stage where they're kind of, well, I guess some of them are kind of 15, turning 16 and stuff. They're getting older. And I don't know, but I'd imagine Eve is kind of frozen in time for you as a 13-year-old.
Completely.
You know, does that cause the grief to come back, waves of it, or does it compound it? You know, when you do, you get does it reinforce that sense of a lost future?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if your grandparent dies and they can have brought you up and you can be super close, but if they died 100, you go, that's loss, but that's a life well lived.
Yeah.
When your child dies, that's loss and that's potential loss. I mean, I text Eve's friends' mothers every now and then to check in and see how they're doing, and had a coffee with one of them before Christmas. And it's lovely to see them grow up, but it's bittersweet, you know, because Eve should be there too.
Yeah.
And, but look, they're fantastic girls. And, I suppose I take joy in knowing them. Seeing the people that they're going to become, you know, that's
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I guess, you know, the lost future in the early days is kind of an abstract concept. It's when her friends experience things that she won't, that it becomes kind of tangible.
Absolutely. And you talk about being frozen in time. Myself and Eve made two playlists for the hospital visits. And whenever I want to feel a little bit closer to Eve, I still play them. But that's the music she was into when she was 13.
Yeah.
She'd be too cool to listen to it now.
Yeah.
Or she'd have grown on to something else. But I don't know what that is. I'll never know what that is.
Yeah.
So what I have is all I have.
And so is it... But because you'll always have that, you'll always have to deal with that. Whenever you hear those songs, you know, she'll be a constant absence, like a presence, but an absence in your lives, and there's no escaping it. You know, it means it's a process that never ends, is it, the grieving one?
No, you navigate it and you live with it for the rest of your life. And that's kind of what I was trying to allude to in the beginning, is you can't push it away. You can't fight it. It's going to be with you. It's going to be there forever. So the sooner you get up, once you've gotten over the shock, like I was when I was with you last time, and you learn to sort of navigate it or forge this relationship that you can live the rest of your life with, the better off you'll be. And for me, there was a number of things you can do. I mean, I think it's so important to look after your mental health.
Yeah.
And the science, peer-reviewed science supporting meditation, is well documented for any of your listeners who experience grief. Jack Kornfield wrote an excellent, he's an American meditation teacher, and he's written an excellent book on beginner's meditation that I used. Physical health is just so important. Taking exercise. There was a really recent and interesting peer-reviewed article from the UK that showed people who participate in health in nature, so going for hikes or gardening, have twice the benefits from people who go to counsellors.
Wow.
That was pretty incredible.
Yeah.
There's a peer-reviewed article in the British press. So, and that's affordable to everybody. We can all go out. We can all go for a hike up the Dublin Mountains. We can all garden a little bit, even if it's just growing a few herbs in a window box. You know, we can all do that. The benefit of that is just, it's there for us,
yeah,
for everybody.
Hugh, listen, thanks a million for coming back into us for the chat. I really mean it. Thanks a million.
Thanks so much, Kieran. Thank you.
Yeah. Hugh McElveen. Stay with us. Lots still to come on the show.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.